Please pray with me. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be pleasing in your sight, O God, our rock and our redeemer. One particularly cold day last winter, I encountered a woman panhandling outside the grocery store in our neighborhood. I stopped to chat with her for a couple of minutes. She was a refugee from Eastern Europe, I can't remember where, and the money she was making wasn't making ends meet for her and her three kids. I will admit, I am always leery of people in these situations, but I also always don't want to be the person who didn't help someone genuinely in need because of my own suspicion. In this case, my dilemma isn't what's relevant. I grocery shopped, and when I came out of the store, there was a man standing by the woman yelling at her. Completely aghast, I went back over and asked what was going on. Through sobs, the woman conveyed that the man kept yelling and she didn't understand what he was asking her. I turned my attention to the yelling human and asked what the problem was. I just want to know what she's done with all the money the government gave her. I just want to know what kind of house they gave her. I bet it's nicer than my house. I'm just asking questions. I'm just asking questions. This seems to be the most recent tagline in a series of self-excusing sentences used by people to berate others while trying to make them seem like they are doing nothing wrong. There's nothing inherently wrong with asking questions, of course. It's how we learn. But this man's questions were not designed to actually elicit information. They were accusations in the form of questions, like some twisted version of xenophobic jeopardy. I would like to say that when confronted with some home truths about refugees, that he backed down, but he kept at it until a few more people started gathering around, and then, like all bullies, when confronted by a group standing up to him, he slunk off to his truck. The Sadducees in the Luke passage today are more of these just asking questions types. They too are wanting to look like they are innocently inquiring. No ulterior motive here, folks. We just want to learn something. Except that, like the man in the grocery store parking lot, their intent is anything but innocent. For a little context, this interaction with the Sadducees is the third round of innocent questions found in Luke 20. At the beginning of the chapter, the chief priests, some legal experts, and some elders challenge Jesus with the question, "What kind of authority do you have for doing these things? Who gave you this authority? We're just asking questions." In the second instance, we are told that these legal experts and priests, having been handily sat down by Jesus's response to their not so innocent question, send in spies who pretend to be sincere. But of course, they are trying to trap him into saying something actionable, something they can use against him with the Roman authorities. And these spies, after some very flattering introductory sentences, pose their question. Does the law allow people to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Oh, they must really think they've got him this time. Of course, they are anticipating a response that will be anti-Rome, which would give them cause to haul this rabble-rouser before the Roman authorities. Jesus, unsurprisingly, does not take the bait and answers by looking at whose image is on the coin, a story we've probably all heard, and telling the questioners, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." It's an almost crafty answer that simultaneously avoids trouble while sidestepping the fact that everything that is Caesar's is also God's. But that is a topic for another sermon. So after this group of Sadducees figure they'll have a go. The Sadducees, remember, are a wealthy group during the Second Temple period. They held much religious and political power, many of them being high priests. If anyone was going to trap this backwater preacher, I am sure they were certain it was going to be them. They proceed to ask a rather long-winded question, invoking the most ludicrous use of Levirate marriage that they could imagine. Levirate marriage, was the practice whereby a young widow still in her childbearing years would marry one of her deceased husband's brothers. The brother would subsequently name the oldest male born by his new wife after his dead brother, so that, according to Deuteronomy, his brother's legacy would not be forgotten in Israel. This was by no means a requirement for how, and women, it is stipulated in Deuteronomy how a woman can refuse this marriage, but most evidence suggests that this practice wasn't even in practice, not even taking place at all at the time that the Sadducees posed this question. Regardless, a key thing of note differentiating Sadducees from Pharisees was their unbelief in the resurrection. So the question really, it makes little sense from the beginning to end. So the Sadducees describe the repeated marriage of a poor woman to a series of seven brothers. In the end, the woman winds up widowed seven times and still childless before her own demise. And the primary concern to these very righteous men is who the woman will be married to at the resurrection. So possibly a little surprising, I am not going to delve into the patriarchy on display in this practice, but instead we're going to talk about Jesus' answer, because honestly, the patriarchy is pretty clear, but Jesus' answer, a little bit less so. The first part of the answer addresses a fundamental understanding of the concept of resurrection, something which, remember, these Sadducees don't believe in anyway. But the flaw in the question comes in not understanding that there is a difference between this age, where we are possessed of flesh and bone bodies, and that age, where the resurrected will be like angels, according to Jesus. There is clearly a distinction here between our creaturely bodies and what comes after. And entire PhDs, I'm sure, have been written about these differences. But I think the important takeaway from this might be that there are things about the other side of the veil that we do not understand. Jesus goes on to be even more cryptic, talking about Moses and the burning bush. Again, there's a lot to unpack here. The key point for today is that when God speaks to Moses and identifies as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that those fathers of the faith are already living again in the eyes of the Lord. Now, this may point away from a second bodily resurrection, or it may point away from a Jewish idea that the dead are just dead until Messiah comes. But for my purposes this morning, this is not an in-depth exploration of Jewish beliefs about resurrection. So we will just leave that discussion also to others. The point of the entire chapter, as I see it, is encapsulated in verses 45 to 47, which aren't actually included in the lectionary for today, but added to the readings by me, because I think they make the point. Here they are again. In the presence of all the people, Jesus said to the disciples, "Watch out for the legal experts. They like to walk around in long robes. They love being greeted with honor in the markets. They long for the places of honor in the synagogues and at banquets. They are the ones who cheat widows out of their homes, and to show off, they say long prayers. They will be judged most harshly." These legal experts who are trying to trip Jesus up to give themselves some advantage, who are behaving in ways that the people can see are not in keeping with the law, are not to be trusted. These Sadducees who thought they could trick Jesus by invoking ideas about the resurrection have missed the point. Whether they believe in the resurrection or not, the same point, they're missing the point. The point that all the questions in Luke are missing, that as human creatures, we are incredibly prone to focusing on the wrong things. In verse 42, Jesus gives a very specific example of cheating widows out of their homes. Perhaps a reference to the acts of a particular onlooker, or perhaps a general indication of how willing to stoop to cheat the most vulnerable these people are for their own gain. These sorts of people need to be cautioned against. These people are not just asking questions. They are seeking leverage. 2 Thessalonians also carries a warning about being deceived. Paul, or whoever wrote the letter, is concerned about confusion being sown in the church at Thessalonica, that the second coming was imminent or indeed already upon them. First and foremost, the author seeks to reassure them this is not the case. And following some verses that are a little too close in description to a certain president, he gives them a solution to their deception. Stand firm in your dedication to God, your belief in the truth, and the traditions that you have been taught in the name of Jesus. These passages called me back to Caleb's sermon from last week, specifically his call for us to learn the lessons of being faithful while being in powerless situations came to mind. There are things happening in Thessalonica that are disturbing and confusing to the church there. And the way they counter it is by remaining faithful to what they know is true. They resist in the face of deception by embracing the teachings of Jesus, by remembering that they are the first crop of the harvest called to the good news through the love of Creator God. If we think about it, the crowd surrounding Jesus is hearing a similar instruction, that they can tell the people who shouldn't be trusted by looking at their actions, all of their actions. Do they put on a good show in the temple but ignore the law of Moses when there is personal or financial gain to be had? Jesus' audience also can spot deception through focus on faith in what God instructed through Moses in its entirety. I go back to Caleb's sermon from last week, not surprisingly, as the lectionary passages do often build on each other. Caleb spoke of being faithful when we are powerless, and while part of me feels like I'm giving a sermon with the exact same point, I would suggest that while Caleb challenged us to remain faithful even when we feel we have no power, I am building on that idea, encouraging us to stand strong in our faithfulness when we are challenged by things that contradict that which we know in faith to be true. I said earlier that Jesus' answers to the three questions in Luke 20 strongly suggest that we humans are focused on the wrong things. Some might say that I have engaged in my own form of missing the point this morning. After all, both of these passages are speaking of end times events and prophecies. Surely that should have been the focus. Surely there should have been an attempt to try and find good news in the end time texts. That must be the point of the scriptures appearing here together. And I wouldn't disagree with you. I am sure that these two scriptures being listed together in the lectionary gives rise to many sermons about end times theologies. But I wonder if in seeking answers to the parousia, or the second coming, we might actually be missing the point. As Patrick Wilson says in his Feasting on the Word commentary on these passages, Jesus does not answer any questions about the resurrection of believers. He doesn't address the subject of the question at all. Instead, Jesus chooses to focus on the lack of understanding shown by the question. Jesus doesn't dignify the actual question with a response. He refuses to engage their trap. Instead, bringing focus to God and what we can learn about God from Moses, the scribe of the law they're questioning. Jesus chooses not to focus on the weaponized question, but instead takes the opportunity to possibly do some teaching, to highlight the points of faith that are relevant to the trick. We are told that, unlike the gentleman in my parking lot encounter, the Sadducees back down, realizing that Jesus isn't going to buy their innocent asking questions, even to the point that scripture tells us that no one dared ask him anything else. I am sadly sure that the parking lot man has gone on to not so innocently ask questions of other people in vulnerable positions and places. It would be arrogant of me to presume that one encounter where he was challenged would alter his perception of the situation and his presumed rights within it. And lately, it seems that we encounter people like this everywhere. At work, at school, on the news, on our social media feeds, we cannot seem to get away from people who are trying to trick us into believing that they are right and righteous in their behaviors. But we, like the Thessalonians, know what is right. We too have been given firm traditions in Jesus Christ on which to stand. We know that people wielding questions like weapons against the poor, the oppressed, and the outcast are not innocent knowledge seekers. When faced with such a barrage of disinformation packaged as innocent questions, we know that we can turn to the one who saw through the deceit. We can lean on the traditions we have learned from the Bible and the one who encourages our hearts and gives us strength in the face of those who would deceive us. In the name of the Creator, the Human One, and the Indwelling Spirit.